even though we were preparing women to be investor ready, there was also the capital side of the equation that almost needed to be persuaded to invest in particular women. It wasn't as if it was just a one-off scenario. We were seeing this across the continent and have come to realize that it is a global gap in itself.
Welcome to Shoka's Podcast. I'm Jessica Espinosa, and this is Shifting Capital, the podcast that connects you with the most innovative fund managers, entrepreneurs, and investors from around the world. Today, I'm speaking with Anya Chikava, Investment Director at the Gresham Michel Trust in Kenya. Anya has over 17 years' experience in fund management and is driving women's economic empowerment goals. She's a global thought leader in gender lens investing and is one of the first female fund managers in Africa. She has been instrumental in the setup of two fund management companies from scratch in Kenya, where she served in each as Managing Director. She's also the lead consultant and co-author of a 2017 research published by the Gresham Michel Trust called Growth Barriers Affecting Female Entrepreneurs in East Africa, and is currently leading the conceptual and founding team at the Gresham Michel Trust to create a gender lens investment vehicle for Africa. Anya has won numerous awards for her work. She was named Top 40 Under 40 in East Africa Business Daily, as well as one of 50 people to watch in Africa by Africa Report. She was nominated Most Influential Woman in Africa and Financial Services by CEO Magazine, and she was awarded Diversity and Inclusion Business Executive Champion in Kenya by the National Diversity Inclusion Awards and Recognition. She's the founding chairperson of New Faces, New Voices Kenya, a women in finance network, an advisory board member for Kenya's Women Enterprise Fund, and an Investment Advisory Council member for Canada's Equality Fund. Hi, Anya.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks. Thank you so much for joining us for this podcast today. We're very excited to have you.
I'm excited to be here too.
Great. So, Anya, tell us about the fund you're raising for the Gresham Michel Trust and your unique investment thesis.
So at the Gresham Michel Trust, it's a Pan-African advocacy organization that really focuses on women and children's rights. This year is our 11th year of operation. And during that time, we have done basically all things women, from build and strengthen women's networks to actually support women with their technical assistance. Through a variety of programs that we run. We have also basically supported women's leadership, and we have also encouraged women's participation in various sectors, whether those sectors are there because of women's presence, such as agriculture, which is the core in the African continent, or there are sectors where we feel women can be influential and change the discourse. These are sectors such as finance and media. And it is through this journey, we've also done a number of research, a collaboration with different institutions, really to promote women's financial inclusion. And it's through all of this programmatic work, which I haven't really scratched the surface of, and our interaction with women across the continent, that we realized that there was an unexplainable gap in capital flowing to women businesses. So it was through undergoing our work of being the champion and advocate of women that we recognized that there were some serious gaps and how money flows to women in business. Now, I say this being coming from an investment background, being a member of Gresham Michelle's Trust, Women in Finance Network, and really providing our support to women in businesses through supporting investor readiness programs. But as a result, it really turned out that even though we were preparing women to be investor ready, there was also the capital side of the equation, which is the supply side, that almost needed to be persuaded, convinced, provided with evidence to invest in particular women. And what we saw was, it wasn't as if it was just a one-off scenario. We were seeing this across the continent and have come to realize that it is a global gap in itself. So our investment thesis is really catering to these gaps, which really focuses on the fact that we know women themselves as founders may not necessarily raise their hands in the traditional front when you're looking for deal sourcing. So on that particular area, we're able to leverage our relationships that we have with women that are present, not only in our networks, but also go beyond our networks. And we were basically working off our social capital because over the years, we have demonstrated that we have been advocating for women, either through our programmatic areas or through our partnerships. So what we realized, especially when we started partnering with organizations that were specifically mobilizing women, it was really difficult to get women to raise their hand and basically identify themselves. So we recognized right away that the investment process, all from deal sourcing all the way until the exit, but before that, if we talk about portfolio management, has got to recognize the different approaches that you need to involve and include women. And we felt that one of the most successful ways of doing that was actually by ring fencing and really doing sort of a woman-only window initiative. So when we talk about our fund, we talk about an initiative that is designed by African women for African women. So we are female fund managers that have worked on this thesis based on our observations with the women in our network, our observations and interactions through our potential pipeline, as well as the research that we did where we co-authored on growth barriers affecting women entrepreneurs in East Africa. Another area we really wanted to identify is really addressing the size of women businesses. We recognize that most women businesses really were on the smaller end. And on the smaller end, we're talking about women making up really almost a third of medium enterprises and really dropping to single digits when we're thinking of larger enterprises. And we were curious as to why this was the case, because whenever firms were doing deal sourcing and the traditional sort of private equity industry was looking for deals, it was very, very hard to support a female founder, especially if the deal size was above $5 million. And based on the women that we also interacted with, we realized that we could count these women on possibly one or two hands max. And we wondered, well, why is that the case? Because women are entrepreneurs. A lot of them are more entrepreneurs than even male counterparts across the continent. They're running businesses, whether it's on cross-border trade, whether it's informally, whether it's out of their homes. We're all working from home now, so it seems normal. But women have been doing that for years and decades. as well as having their own job, if it's a paid job, and having a side business on the side. You know, I remember even like being in very professional environments and, you know, women saying, oh, I'm selling eggs. Would you like some eggs tomorrow? But so here we were wondering, we know women have the entrepreneurial spirit, but why is it that their businesses are small? And we realized when we also explored the growth barriers and we engaged women directly, is that very few of them actually relied on external financing. So the default was to self-finance their particular business. And the reason why they self-finance their particular business is because they were sure that they could actually put that capital in as they needed to. They were sure that there was a level of patience that was associated with that particular capital. And they were actually looking for some flexibility. With women also having various responsibilities. And we noticed that the dominant players that have been interacting with the female space, mainly microfinance providers, didn't necessarily have these particular terms. They've done quite a good job at providing capital to businesses that have quite a number of predictable cash flows. But what we were seeing, especially as in a continent like Africa, where there are so many young people that are coming into the workforce, and these young people don't necessarily have the particular traditional white collar job waiting for them. They don't necessarily have that. And then they go into entrepreneurship, not only as a survival, but as a chance to basically innovate and solve problems. And that was the entrepreneur that we sought to basically capture and really look and say, well, what sort of financing would be best suited for this particular target group? And the financing, as it comes across, is really a combination of grants, a combination of debt, mainly mezzanine options, and in certain cases, and convertible debt as well, and in certain cases, pure equity. So making sure that we reflected design when we were looking at the particular target group. Another area where we're looking at is that we have absolutely no apologies when we're looking at an investment thesis of going after women as founder. And women as founder, we're talking about 50 plus one. And then because we have been faced with scenarios where people have put quotas and have favored the fact that a woman is a founder, but you find that the women themselves don't have an active role in the management of the business. So we didn't want to create a scenario where businesses are being fronted by women, but they're not necessarily being run by women. So we are very, very explicit on having sort of women leadership as well in the business, so that we know that we're basically facilitating, whether it is the knowledge transfer as well as the wealth transfer. Other areas that we have done in our investment thesis that we have found exciting, when we interviewed our database, we found that almost 50% of the women that we talked to had a product and service that was solving a problem or was targeted to the female segment. So we're talking about entrepreneurs that are focused on skincare, that can support things like eczema, that are focused on sexual reproductive health, supportive tools that can basically have more biodegradable ways of disposing sanitary towels or improving access. We also had people that were looking at clothing for curvy women. So a whole variety of products that were dealing with natural hair, our own natural hair, and really coming about because they couldn't find anything in the market that could work for them. So we found that we were also dealing with an underserved segment where people were actually using products or solutions that weren't necessarily designed or shaped or accounted for women. But this woman entrepreneur that we were backing was basically solving a problem, which allowed us to get a lot of innovative products out there. So really highly supportive of female-centric innovation. We also, as a last area when I'm looking at our fund, has been very deliberate about what we do about sectors. So there are certain sectors of focus that I've mentioned, like agriculture, in education, where we found a lot of women participating, but maybe their participation can basically be improved in terms of sort of the power ratio that women have in those particular roles, where they sit within the value chain, the access to markets they have, or the quality of buyers that they have, or the actual size of the business itself and how it competes. So really using those sectors that women are already prevalent to uplift the participation of women, but also recognizing the transformation that can occur when you're dealing with a sector such as manufacturing and technology. And in these sectors, it's really being deliberate, and even energy, being deliberate in seeking out women that are operating in male-dominated industries and supporting these women because they are the ones that actually become the role models for the next generation of female entrepreneurship, female leadership, and overall perception about what women can or cannot do.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. And I think it's really interesting how you have, first of all, done this research, which, you know, seems to be kind of the obvious way to go about it. But I mean, to be honest, it hasn't really happened much in the investment industry. Otherwise, we wouldn't have had these historic gaps and this mismatch between what entrepreneurs actually need and what has been out there in the market. And I wonder if you have found any insights or what's your view on the reasons why this has been the case for so long? Why have these entrepreneurs been so underfunded? And also, why have the traditional kind of investment products that are out there or the financing products not been tailored to their real needs?
I mean, that's a tough question, but I'm going to try and answer it, Jessica. I think one of the reasons it was underserved, you know, there is this saying that says, what doesn't get measured doesn't get done. And I feel that we were just not keeping track of it. And I say this because even when we started recognizing that there was a disparity, and remember right now, this disparity was almost like hearsay. It was like at every meeting we went and we're dealing with women, they're like, we can't get business. But remember, on the other side, we're dealing with, at that point, it was predominantly the banking sector. And there was a huge sort of gap in terms of, well, we can't get funding. And the pushback was like, well, do you meet the requirements? Now, it's only when you start uncovering what those requirements are. And I say this because I've actually been encouraged by some of the activities I'm seeing in the broader financial system that is like, we're going to work towards uncovering these requirements. I mean, we've seen a lot of work being done by African Development Bank on this, as well as, you know, other development finance institutions, as well as, you know, some of the larger banks. But I think a key impediment, which was raised over, it was just a question of when the market felt this is the time to now do something about it, was about the traditional requirements, the expectations for collateral, and also how the risk is priced, which made the capital itself very expensive. These are things that actually made women themselves self-exclude themselves from the process. Now, you have to think that collateral might be something that's not a big deal in more developed nations. Maybe there are different ways of assessing how to recover some funding. But in emerging markets, in Africa in particular, there is a favoritism towards having hardcore assets. And a hardcore asset is really anything to do with land or anything to do with real estate that you can actually lodge with the bank. But you're talking about a very patriarchal society where women are unlikely to inherit land, even if they're from families that do have land. They're likely to even own the land. And even in cases where they might be married with a partner and actually have access to this land, that can change if the woman is suddenly widowed. So this happens despite the fact that you may have laws and regulations that govern this. There's laws and regulations and there's practice, because practice is a function of culture. So there have been certain countries, and Kenya is included in one of them, that have basically allowed for the immovable assets. And they've basically said, well, can't you accept jewelry? Can't you accept livestock? Unfortunately, and then there's also what we call guarantee funds that are coming up. And that's all what, you know, the whole program at AFAWA is at African, which is really guarantees offered to financial institutions. And what we're talking about is really a behavior change, which means that are we able to assess risk differently? And the question and the answer to that is yes. But to say yes, it means we have to rewrite the rules and we have to be ready to learn things and build new evidence. Now, that is a bit difficult when you're dealing with players that have been relatively successful making good amounts of money by being very passive in maybe some level of deployment, which now requires more active deal sourcing, which is a little bit more expensive, requires a more product development and design, may require a new assessment of risk. So it needs sort of an industry push. And I'm beginning to see that now, because collectively, we as women who are in the financial services industry are a little bit more than we were before. And also have the compassion and have the interest and maybe have the commitment to see it to the very end. And I'm not saying it's all women. I know that there's gender lens funds there that are mixed and they're diverse, but it really needs this to get it to the other side, because it requires sort of doing things in a little different way and measuring as we go along. And the fact that the gender disaggregated data was not really there, that we couldn't tell, we just saw it from an outcome perspective. And an outcome perspective is not asking financial institutions, how many men versus women have bank accounts. We're looking at the credit portfolio in the business banking portfolio in the SME, small and medium enterprise. And we're looking for that particular allocation of what the percentage is between male and women enterprises. And that is where the story was getting told. It was really sitting at an 80-20, if we were lucky. So I think acknowledging that the data, we were not measuring it, it meant that it wasn't necessarily getting done. It also means that if the impact investors or the capital providers that are supplying the people that are allocating capital are not necessarily looking at the allocation and looking at gender more as a post-investment outcome, like how many jobs did you create? How many of these jobs? And in even that, there have been problems in terms of, well, are the jobs really, is there a gender pay gap? Are these jobs ones of influence? Are we only talking about jobs that are created, but they're low-paying jobs? So it's a question of basically measuring it from the beginning, setting a target and saying, well, this is where we are to begin with. But once we deliberately start deploying capital with this intention, we are waiting for this outcome. And we have seen entities, I would like to say, that have chosen to declare where they are in the beginning, really make remarkable changes because it is clear that you're actually moving the needle. So I think that's one of the reasons it took a long time.
Speaking of the industry, you have such an impressive track record in the investment industry. In fact, you are the youngest woman in Kenya to rise to the top of a multinational company. You made managing director at age 30. What has that journey been like, and what have been some of the challenges you've encountered along the way?
Yeah, in terms of that journey, I think when I was at the top of the field, I didn't realize just how rare it was at that time. I think I look back at it and I'm like, wow, that was really something. I look back at my own CV and I'm like, wow, that was something. But I think because I had sort of been initiated straight into financial services from school, I just went straight. I was always in male-dominated industries, which is so funny because I went to an all-girls school. I almost thought that it was just the way life was. It was something that I didn't necessarily question that much at that time. What I do recall, though, is that there were certain differences in terms of how I was perceived vis-a-vis my male colleagues. And this was in relation to whether there had been an outperformance or in certain cases in whether you are trying to manage or address something that could have gone wrong. And I remember, and I distinctly remember this because it's something that, you know, you always remember when you work so hard and we had, you know, achieved our targets and we had, you know, really done remarkably well. You know, we grew a fund from zero to like $100 million and we had really good returns. And I remember somebody made a comment that took me aback, almost like because our sales representatives were doing really well. And I remember somebody saying, they're basically promoting that initiative because they all have silent crushes on Andia. It was almost like, oh, it wasn't your effort. It was because people are trying to impress you because of how they perceive you look. But then it's opposite. If you're trying to solve a problem or you're trying to put out a fire, and then it's like, oh, it's all your fault. Why did this fire take place? And at that point, I think I hadn't really understood gender dynamics very well. We were just putting our head down and trying to get the work done. And it was only after business school, and we were just reflecting within business school, reflecting it within my class, reflecting on the global financial crisis, reflecting that these articles started coming out about where were the women and how women have been sidelined in financial services. And I was able to really join the dots about my own career, which was very, should I say, supportive whenever I was dealing with my male colleagues on a peer level, but became extremely complicated when I was actually, I had oversight over them. And that was something that I wasn't aware of, and I wasn't even prepared. There is this saying that says ignorance is bliss. And I sort of learned the hard way. But I think if I had spoken to an older version of myself, what I know now, I think it would have helped a lot of the sort of imposter syndrome that we all tend to walk around with sometimes. So I was typical of given the glass cliff roles, being given very difficult roles that possibly I would say it would be difficult for a male counterpart to achieve, but the perception, and the perception is not only amongst male colleagues, it's amongst female colleagues too, that haven't necessarily been socialized to see women in roles of power and influence, that are not necessarily used to seeing women in core decision-making roles, that you find the leadership angle gets complicated. So not necessarily the execution when you are doing your work, but basically the leadership angle. But I mean, I still cherish my experience. I still believe I was baptized very early into the workings of corporates. I've been sitting on board since I was 24. I feel like I've done everything under the sun that most people could be getting some exposure to later on in their careers. So I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for finding out fairly early on, which was like in my early 30s, that I needed to drive the women empowerment agenda. And I had to look back at my own career, my own opportunities, and say, well, if this has happened to me or is happening to me, with all the exposure and the experience and the contacts and the networks that I have, then does somebody else who has less of this even stand a chance? And, you know, there's that famous saying, I don't mean to sound cheesy, but by Obama, that says, we are the change that we want to see. So when I look at what we're doing with Gender Lens Investing, I feel it's such a big responsibility. It's such a mandate where you're looking at the industry, you're influencing behavior, you're looking for evidence, elevating particular women that have been running successful businesses, some of them that even have revenues of about over $2 million a year that still can't find funding because of a variety of biases. And you say, well, I'm going to lead and be one of the people that will drive the capital allocation decisions around this, because I understand the risk, I understand the bias. And I'll just give an example. There's a different perception in how maybe a traditional male investor might look at a woman who is married with kids. They could be a different perception in how a male investor might look at a single woman who has never married. And, you know, I think someone can say when they talk about the motherhood penalty, male investors can be seen to be more focused and more deserving or more settled and responsible when they have families. Whereas women can be perceived to be more distracted and less focused in the business. Yet, when we look at the women entrepreneurs that we see people that are fighting to make a better tomorrow for their children's future. We see women that are hungry to be the next very active millionaire, billionaires on the continent. And that affects our decision on whether you're going to not only choose to back an entrepreneur, but you're going to follow them up with a capital and you're going to basically work with them as partners and collaboration. So if you inherently are not used to seeing many successful women, you might not believe in the power and the drive that exists around it. And I would also say the same for single women that are looking for, you know, something else as a level of purpose, that are actually looking for a way to make impact. But all of them have one thing in common. They have the caregiving role, which never goes away, whether a woman has her own family or is looking after the dependents or is looking after relatives. And that caregiving role has an impact on really the level of responsibilities that women hold, which means that as we look at these businesses, we recognize that maybe the time spent on care is different, but we don't penalize women for it and say, oh, because of that, you're not going to be a good entrepreneur. We just have to be aware of the circumstances, especially since that we're talking about COVID, and not necessarily compare apples with oranges. So just that unique insight, I think it has given in terms of how our unconscious biases. And one of the key things I've said, which really, you know, becomes important, especially when you're supporting female fund managers, is that you're working with that bias to basically reduce the gender gap. So I can't say that I'm not biased towards the female segment. I think I'm really biased to them, but that bias is also good because sometimes it's really hard to unlearn bias, and you use that to tilt the disparity gap that where we are today to basically get more businesses more gendered sensitive, more women led, more women owned, more integrating the entrepreneurs within the supply chains, having policies that actually speak to an enabling environment, and really just outwardly doing deliberate outreach that would increase and bring a lot more of the people that have been excluded and allow them to be included.
Yeah, really great point. Could you tell us a bit more about the entrepreneurs that you're backing and their stories?
So we are focused on the African Indigenous women. These are people that have attended local universities. If they have either, we found that a lot of them would have actually possibly been in a job market for a little bit, the older ones, and possibly found that it was not conducive to their growth, so ended up doing something entrepreneurial. They're looking to grow their business. They are early growth stage. That's what I call them. So they're revenue generating, but they might not necessarily be profitable. They've been in operation for at least 3 years. They've got clients on their book. They're either B2B or B2C. They are hungry. They're honest and they're willing to learn. So they have shared, they've demonstrated that through our technical assistance program or participation in other activities or just following up based on the milestones that we engage with them. They're able to meet them and they should have annual turnovers of about $60,000 and above. And they have growth prospects with revenues growing at least 20% year on year.
You made a really interesting point about the role of networks earlier. And in fact, you've built a really inspiring network of women in finance on the African continent. What in your experience makes business networks like these so valuable?
I think one of the good things with a network is that it gives you a safe space and it gives you a sense of community. And what we did, especially when I was sitting and being in a role at a really young age, there were very few women that were in the role I was in. And I was feeling quite lonely. They say it's quite lonely at the top. And I think one of the key things I want to encourage everybody is that your network is not necessarily the people in your neighborhood or the people in the same city or the same country. You can actually build a global network. You can build, and I had to go to the Pan-African environment, to the global environment, even to the professional environment to get the level of support that I needed. And you, once you do that, you find your tribe. And once you find your tribe, when different things happen to you, because they will, you have sounding boards. You have people that maybe have experienced different things and may have advice. I found that it was really difficult when I would, especially when you talk about coaching, I would say I need some advice, and I would have to get advice from, you know, older, male coaches that had been in the leadership positions. But some of the challenges I was facing, it was hard for them to relate because they hadn't necessarily experienced it in that way, and it was biased. And it took a while. It was only retrospectively that I was like, oh, wow, that was biased. But now in our tribe, you almost can call it out and it's easier. Also, when you have a collective problem and we realize, well, this messaging isn't coming across as we would like. We would like more people to shift capital to sub-Saharan Africa. We would actually like more people to really support indigenous entrepreneurs. And you can do all of these big outrageous goals through a network because you can approach a problem collectively. And when you approach a problem collectively, it's really hard to be targeted as, oh, that's the person doing that, and that's the person that should be silenced. So I encourage people to join networks. And if you can't join a network, you build a network, and you build a network across country, regional, and global lines. Because when you find your tribe, you feel more courageous to basically keep pushing. And that's where I have found my courage to keep pushing.
Thank you, Andia. That's really interesting. And I think it will be particularly valuable for the young women who are listening to this podcast and who are just starting their careers. And this actually brings me to my next question. What's your advice for young women who are just starting out and entering the industry?
For young women who are starting out, I would say to them, they have to be willing to try many things. So they have to be able to experiment to find out where their talent is. I think as young women, sometimes, you know, and I think it's how we do the narrative. We tend to underestimate just how much grit, resilience it takes to get to where some of the founders we see today. And the resilience aspect is really important. And knowing that that is combined with hard work. So there is no sort of romantic view. It may appear romantic when somebody is celebrated on the cover of Forbes or on the local dailies, but there's a lot of grit around it. So I think it's more about having that patience to know that good things take time and you're going to have to stick it out. I also know that there's more to be learned from failure than there is success. I've experienced both failure and success, and it is more obvious to me the reasons why I failed than the reasons why I succeeded, you know? It's interesting. So I would encourage young people that when they fail, it means that they are learning, and failure is a chance to reset and to learn. I would also encourage young people to be very clear on their talents, because when you're talented, that's when you can attract a really good mentor, because mentors are usually busy people and they also want to give back, but they also want to give back to talent. So it helps if you're good at what you do. And to be good at what you do, you have to be passionate. So know the real reason why you would actually want to join the particular field. And then one of the key things I've done and I've seen that is giving me a lot of, you know, joy is the aspect of giving back. And this is volunteering time, volunteering set of expertise, sharing networks. There has to be a level of generosity, because people, we grow because of people. And people are always moving from one place to the other. And as people move, the key thing is to grow with them or to lift them. So generosity must happen even if you're an intern. I think it happens all across, and that generosity will see you through. And then always be ready to tell your story, just like the way I've agreed to do this podcast, because that encourages other young people to join the field. If people don't know the story, and when you tell your story, you have to speak authentically, because there are other people that will make decisions based on what you say. So yeah, for young people, it's to know that investing is for women. It's for young women as well. It's not only to make money, but to also make an impact. So how can people use their skills to basically drive capital towards causes that deserve them?
Thanks for the great advice, Andia. And you're such a huge role model for so many women out there. I'd be curious to hear who inspires you.
Oh, yeah, I thought about this and I thought, well, charity begins at home. And I think I need to first thank my parents. My parents are both alive. I thank God that they're both alive. They are extremely generous people. We grew up in a house that was not only full of relatives, but was also full of friends. And whenever my mom was trained as a nurse, and then in our teenage years, she became a stay-at-home mom to be closer to us. And I remember even during the time, and she was a business woman during that time, still doing business on the side, but several working single moms that couldn't really cope to possibly look after their children, my mom used to take those kids in. So she was not a judgmental mother. She was like, oh, you're busy changing the world and you need somebody to help? Come here. So I grew up, I have two sisters, but I grew up with a lot of friends that are like sisters because they were at our house. So the spirit of generosity And my mom's love language has always been food. So our house was always full of food and there was a lot of warmth. With my dad, it's just mainly he's courageous. He was one of these people that got in trouble by the state for encouraging the languages to be written in vernacular. At that point, we were just coming out of independence, and you were thought to be more sophisticated if you could speak the Queen's English as good as anyone. And he was really pushing for Indigenous content. It's come full circle now where, that Indigenous content is now being promoted by the very government that he once, he once faced scrutiny over. And it's one of the pioneering things because he's also published a lot of Africa's authors like Gugi wa Thiong'o or Chinua Achebe. So I feel blessed to come from such strong parents who are still alive, that are still able to give their wisdom. And the last but not least is that my dad himself is also an entrepreneur, and he loved his business so much that to grow the capital, we actually mortgaged our house. And unfortunately, we ended up even losing it. So I know what it's like to be a person in business and to put your whole heart and soul and maybe have the wrong type of capital that maybe is not patient or wasn't necessarily structured in a manner that allowed you to grow your business in a particular way. The business is still alive and standing. It's 50 years old, but our childhood home is not there. But we are still grateful because we are with each other and we still all have a roof over our heads.
Wow, that's so inspiring. Thanks so much for sharing this personal story. And this brings me to my final question for you. Going back to what you mentioned earlier, this inspiring quote about being the change you want to see, what is your vision on the journey to 2030? Where would you like to see the investment industry go? And what's your call to action for our audience?
Oh, yeah, thank you for that. I think where I see the investment industry going is that, I was just looking at some of the stats and I think I was looking at a report and I don't know how updated it is. And it really talked about the investment market really being a $74 trillion when we talk about the global asset management, $24 trillion. And when you look at that, you say, well, this is the amount of money that is in just global asset management. How much of this particular money can we drive towards investing for impact? And when I say investing for impact, I mean that you're still going to make your returns. You're just going to do good. As you make your returns, you're also going to feel good. And we have a chance to do that right now with how the world has been reset with COVID. I really thought that COVID was a passing cloud, but it is not. It's changed how we are going to operate going forward. And we have the unique ability as the investment industry to basically rewrite the rules of what is risk, what is return, what is investable. There are some pretty businesses out there that didn't have capital to begin with. So they were self-financing. Women have always been outside, that have pivoted just out of their own creativity, no sort of emergency loan or grant, but just that quest of survival and have actually bought their business. Even just assessing that ability to transform and pivot has really shown just the spirit, the strength of the human spirit. So when I look at the investment industry, I think this is an industry that can actually take its power back. And when I say take its power back, is that when you look in the paper, sometimes we look at the power and it appears that the power is with the current politicians. It may appear that the power is with our celebrities. But I'll tell you, the real power is with the asset owners and the capital allocators, because we have the power to change the world through how we focus our capital and how we choose to effect change, whether it is through our bonds, whether it is through the private market, whether it is through the listed companies. All of these things can be focused on doing good.
Thank you so much, Andia, for inspiring us with your story and insights. And thanks to all of you for tuning in today. Don't forget to check out Shoko's Indiegogo campaign and join us to empower adolescent girls to leapfrog to digital jobs of the future. Next time, I'll be speaking with Samantha Pockroy, founder and CEO of Sanari Capital, a private equity firm investing in growth companies emanating from Africa with regional and global scalability and exposure.